So I'm Dr. Ann Louise Lockhart. I'm a pediatric psychologist and parent coach in San Antonio, Texas. And I'm very, very happy to be talking to you all today. And we are going to be talking about anxiety and covering kind of the range of anxiety because it's one of the most common diagnoses out there. And it's something that shows up not just for kids and teenagers, but also for adults. So if you have a child who's struggling with it, it's also important to know that really the interventions and strategies work for all ages. You just adapt it a little bit based on their age group. So I'm originally from St. Croix in the Virgin Islands. I was born and raised there, and I've moved all over. I went to college in Buffalo, New York. That's a longer story. And then went to Indiana for grad school, and then Toledo, and then California, where I met my husband, who is here today, so thank you. He came for the food. And then we moved to San Antonio 17 years ago. We've been married 23 years, yes. Right? Okay. 23 years, and we have two kids, ages 9 and 11. So I'm very happy to be here and talking to you about this issue. So before we get started, after I'm finished presenting everything, then I'll open it up for questions. So if you have any specific scenarios or issues that are going on, we can kind of rapid fire a lot of those questions. So hold on to those questions. I want to make sure I get to all of those as well, too. Okay, so we're going to talk about most common fears, the difference between fear, worry, and anxiety, because we use those interchangeably and it's often incorrect, when it shows up, why it shows up, and then also some practical tips, because that's the real issue. Like, what do I do when? Okay, so as we get started, I want to show you the most common fears. There's 10 of them. I don't want you Googling these right now. But when you look at these, I want you to see if you can figure out like what these mean, because there are like tons of phobias out there. Okay, phobia is a specific fear of something. Okay, so what do you think these mean? So what is arachnophobia?
Spiders.
Okay. What about ophidiophobia? Yes. Awesome. Acrophobia. A fear of acrobats, we have open spaces. Okay, so we'll get to that in a moment. What about aerophobia? Okay. Cynophobia?
Cynophobia.
All right, we'll get to that. Astrophobia?
Meteors.
All right, we'll get to that since you all don't know that one. Trypanophobia. Fear of falling. Okay, now social phobia.
No, right.
Fear of other talking. Okay, agoraphobia.
Leaving the house.
Okay, and then mysophobia. No, that's a good guess though. Okay. All right, so this kind of gives you some hints into what some of these are. And these are the 10 most common phobias that are occurring overall. Okay, I'll define them in a moment. Does anything seem more obvious now as you look at it? So acrophobia, no, it's not a fear of acrobats. Okay, so arachnophobia, spiders and arachnids, one of the most common ones. Fear of snakes, so you all were right with that one. Acrophobia is fear of heights. Okay, so like acrobats because they are high. Okay. Aerophobia, fear of flying. That's a very, very common one. Cynophobia, fear of dogs. I would think it would be like canophobia. Astrophobia, fear of thunder and lightning. Okay. I get that one a lot when I see kids with anxieties. They have that's a big one. Fear of injections. And that's a big reason why a lot of people avoid dentists, doctors, going to their yearly exam. Because really, once you hit 12 and you don't need to do vaccines anymore, for a lot of people, they just don't go back. Okay? Social phobia, fear of social situations. Agoraphobia, fear of being alone when you don't think an escape might be easy. So if you're like in a crowd or in a concert or in a room and you're like, okay, where's the exits? Okay? And then excessive fear of germs and dirt is mysophobia. And that really skyrocketed when the pandemic started, of course, because it was a realistic fear, right? But then, you know, my husband and I were joking, like, man, we were like wiping down groceries and spraying boxes and taking off our shoes and, you know, and then we're like, okay, that's a little bit excessive. So these are all the ones that are the most common, and these are things that show up. It tends to start in childhood, which is why we need to be aware of them, because most fears, they are happening because we are avoiding, right? Because avoiding makes you feel better. But the problem with avoiding is that it maintains and reinforces fears. Okay, so people often think, oh, well, if my kid is afraid of dogs, then let's just avoid dogs. Let's take the way, the roundabout way. Or if I'm afraid of flying, then I'll just drive 24 hours. But the thing is, the more you avoid, the more you reinforce. So always remember, avoidance feeds fear, always. So whenever you're looking at a good intervention, it should always involve facing it rather than avoiding it. Now, I'm not saying like facing it in terms of flooding, right? So we're not gonna be like, oh, I'm afraid of snakes. I'm gonna put you in a room full of snakes. Like, that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about slow and incremental exposure. So that way we can face the thing that we're fearful of and then overcome it eventually, okay? So 12.5% of adults in the US have some type of phobia, and it's most common in women, and it's the second most common in men. And the three categories tend to be social phobias, then agoraphobia, so the fear of, I don't think I can escape the situation, and then specific phobias, like the ones I just mentioned. Okay, so those tend to be, when you look in our diagnostic manual for psychology, if you go to a psychologist or a therapist because you have a phobia or some kind of fear or anxiety, it's typically gonna go in one of these categories, okay? Now there's tons of other kinds of anxiety because it's one of the most common ones besides anxiety. So you have things like post-traumatic stress disorder, which is another category. It's more in the trauma category, but it's still an anxiety response. Selective mutism was also placed in anxiety category, and that's where kids are speaking in certain environments and not in others. So maybe they're a chatterbox at home, but then they don't speak at all when they're in school or in other places. Most kids will develop it around age 2 or 3, and then it just spontaneously goes away about age 8 or 9, okay? Let's see, I'm trying to think of other areas. Obsessive compulsive disorder is a big one. And so OCD can start out from a fear of germs and then become something where it becomes time consuming. So washing your hands so much or showering consistently, wiping down surfaces consistently. So the anxiety is a huge, huge category and it involves a lot of different diagnoses. And it's something to be aware of because the problem with it is that people think, oh, it'll just go away with time. But the problem is that it gets worse with time. It doesn't get better with time. Okay, so then what's the difference? So worry is a feeling of unease. You know, I'm worried about my test tomorrow. I'm worried that, you know, no one's gonna like me at my new school. I'm worried that you might leave and not come back. I'm worried that I might have a bad dream, okay? So it's just a feeling of just feeling uneasy. Stress is feeling of emotional or physical tension. Fear is an emotional response to a real or perceived imminent threat. So I might have a fear of something, but you know, maybe it could really happen. What if I, you know, go to this place and I'm not accepted? Well, it could happen, or the perception is that no one likes me, so that could still be a fear. And then anxiety is an anticipation of a future threat. So a lot of times this anticipation of going to the doctor and getting a shot, or anticipation of not being liked in a new situation. All of these things can breed a lot of a big anxiety response. So then what's normal, okay? So it's common to feel afraid at times. I think we often want kids to get over their anxieties, but it's normal to feel afraid. And it's also, fear is actually a really good thing because it tells us that we have to be cautious. You know, an example I use with some of the kids that I would see is, you know, like, if you, like with Batman, right? Bruce Wayne, the situation may have turned out very differently because parents realized, well, don't go down that really dark alley, Batman. Like, that's crime alley. Like, don't go down that place because we should be cautious. There's something in our gut that tells us when something is not safe. So fear is actually an adaptive response. It's a good thing. And when we don't know what to expect and we don't have a file on it, that's what often breeds anxiety. So if we don't know how to deal with a bully every time we go to school, and we don't have a schema or a set of ways, a script, a way to respond, a problem-solving strategy, then we tend to get anxious because we don't have this file to go to. Lots of us as adults, we've experienced so many different things. We know how to deal with certain things, how to deal with rejection or failure or disappointment. A lot of our kids don't know how to deal with that because they don't have a file on it. Or they've had a very maladaptive or negative response to it and they didn't turn out well. Okay? So when we look at what's normal, it's a good thing to have fear. We just don't want it to take over our life. Something is considered an anxiety disorder when it is exponentially big, amplified, or it causes a significant disruption in your life. So it's okay to not want germs in your body. But if you are spending so much time washing your hands, cleaning everything all the time, where you're not living your life, you're never going outside, then that may be considered more of a disorder. If you are fearful of snakes, but you never go outside, and you never go hiking, you never go out and you live in the wilderness, and you never go anywhere, it can become a maladaptive response because you're not living your life. So anxiety is when something really is bigger than it needs to be, and it's taking up a large amount of your time where you can't just show up the way you need to. So common fears by age. So infants, about 8 or 9 months, they're gonna be afraid of strangers. That's stranger anxiety, that's very normal. So when you just wanna pass on your baby to some random person at 9 months and they're afraid, they should be, okay? That's normal. Toddlers, between about 10 months and 2 years, they're gonna be fearful of separation from their caregiver. So being dropped off at daycare and just like, see ya, deuces, like they're going to be afraid, okay? That's a normal response, okay? Children 4 to 6 years, they're afraid of pretend things like Bigfoot, zombies, and vampires, things that are pretend, because what do we often tell them? We tell them a lot of stories about pretend things. Santa Claus, and fairies, and Easter Bunny, all these random things that are pretend, and then they're like, well, what if this thing happens? So I remember several years ago, there was this video game that came out, and I'm like, this is like the worst thing ever. Five Nights at Freddy's. It is horrible game, okay, for kids. I think someone is aware of it. Okay.
I'm only a child in the room.
But this game, it plays off of kids' fears, because what it is, it's like this place that has all these animatronic animals, and they come to life because some evil spirit possesses it or something crazy like that. And then what happens, they hide under kids' beds, the vent, or their closet. So these are all things that kids are already afraid of, and it plays off of that, okay? So I tell parents, if your kids are online, they have a phone, they have a device, they're on YouTube, they're watching TV, you should be aware of the stuff they're watching. You should be aware of the YouTubers they're following. You should be aware of the kind of video games you give them access to, okay? Because there is some creepy stuff out there. They even have merchandise for these things, okay? At Walmart, I've seen them. Lunch boxes and thermoses, okay? So these pretend things, really, I had kids who had a legitimate post-traumatic stress response because of this video game, okay? So that's the pretend is a big one at this age. Then 7 years plus, they start to become afraid of things that can happen in real life, like death or illness, or destruction, or my home being wiped away by a tornado, like things that could actually happen, they start to be afraid around this age. And then preteens and teens, they tend to have a lot of social fears and anxieties about rejection, being dumped, being, you know, isolated, ignored, that kind of stuff. So these are all common things that we need to just be aware of. Other common childhood fears are things like darkness, being left alone in the dark, animals, fires, high places, thunderstorms, TV news reports, burglars, kidnappers, war, health, and death. So having the TV on as background noise on the news is not a good idea for children. They don't need to be aware of every single thing that happens in the world whenever something horrible happens, okay? So these are all things that, again, things that can actually happen is when it starts to happen about 8-7. So why do we become dysregulated? Now, dysregulated is about being unbalanced, okay? Our body is constantly trying to get itself in balance all the time. You go outside, if it's hot,
and you're exerting yourself, your heart rate starts to increase, you start to sweat, you start to feel fatigued, the sweat cools down your body, your heart rate starts to increase some more, and then eventually cools down. It's balance. If your heart rate goes up for too long, too intensely, or you're not able to cool off enough, you're gonna get overheated and may get a heat stroke, okay? So our body is constantly trying to regulate itself. Our brain does the same thing. It tries to, at least. So when things are uncertain, unpredictable, unknown, or uncomfortable, we will become dysregulated. And that's what fear does. It dysregulates us in some way. And oftentimes we have fear responses in a physical way. We may also have an emotional, cognitive, behavioral, like pacing, wringing your hands, that kind of stuff. So when we are not sure of something and we don't, again, like I said earlier, have a script for something, we will become dysregulated and unbalanced. And how does that show up for kids? You see meltdowns, you see tantrums, you see eye rolling and sassiness and attitude, irritability, withdrawn. There's a whole range of stuff. But when you look at it and you think, oh, my kid is getting an attitude, well, it might be having to do with them trying to get regulated. Now, tantrums is a great example of that, okay? When a kid is having a tantrum, it's often in response to something that they want, right? Give me a candy for dinner. No, it'll rot your teeth. Move it, okay? So they're trying to get something that they want. There's a real reason for that. But then if they get themselves too worked up, it can turn into a meltdown. And a meltdown is different than a tantrum. A meltdown does not have an end goal. A meltdown is an attempt to regulate itself. Because I feel hot, hungry, in pain, uncomfortable, whatever it is, because now if I've been screaming for an hour and now my body temperature has increased and I'm snotting and sweating, my body's trying to regulate itself, okay? And it's all an attempt to regulate. But as a parent, if you're not aware of what's going on with your kid, you're gonna respond in a way that's not gonna be helpful, okay? So we need to feel safe, secure, and stable to function, and we need to have our basic needs met. So if our basic needs aren't being met, we're not gonna go to higher order needs. So I heard a lot of this over early in the pandemic, where people would say something like, okay, you've been stuck at home for 6.5 months. If you haven't published that novel, then what are you doing,
yeah.
Right? And it's like, okay, well, dude, I'm trying to survive, right? That's our basic order. We're trying to stay safe and survive. So in order to publish a novel and to meet a bunch of people and start a Facebook group, that's higher order needs. That's not as important as keeping ourselves safe. And if you have fears and phobias and anxieties and worries, you're not going to think about all of those higher order things. Okay. Same thing goes for our kids. I've been speaking to a lot of schools over the past couple of years, especially, where they're expecting these kids to be on Zoom and showing up and doing their homework and doing a bunch of busy work, honestly. And then they're wondering why kids aren't showing up, why they're not doing the work. It's like, well, I mean, they're literally, some of these kids were on screens all day long, Zoom fatigue, eye fatigue, neck fatigue, all these things. And then we're wanting them to do these big things that they're just like, I'm just trying to like make it day to day, okay? So we wanna really pay attention to the dysregulation piece. So this is one I really like from Movement Matters. They're on Instagram. And the ones on the left are the senses that we're really aware of. The visual, sound, taste, hearing, and touch. We're very much aware that this is what is going on outside of the body, how we interact with the world. But there's also another type of sensory system that we're often not aware of that plays a huge role in terms of anxiety. Okay? So vestibular. Inner ear and your balance of your inner ear. If you have a kid with chronic ear infections, care with a kid with hearing issues, ear tubes, that could affect them in terms of how balanced or how clumsy, how coordinated they are. Okay. Proprioception is knowing where your limbs and your body is in space. Okay. So just being able to move about in this world. Okay. You know, if something you touch is something is slimy or whatever. And then interoception is the one that's most impacted by anxieties and phobias. Any idea what interoception is? No? So interoception is being aware of what's going on inside of your body. Knowing when you're hungry and thirsty or full, when you have to poop and pee. All of that is interoception. Being aware of your body enough to know what to do.
So many times individuals with anxiety and panic disorder and panic attacks, their interoception is heightened because now their heart is racing and they're like, oh my gosh, I must be anxious. And what I found is sometimes I'll talk to kiddos and I'll say, okay, why did you think you were anxious? Okay, well, I went to Six Flags and I was meeting up with my friends and I was so happy to see them and was about to ride the roller coaster and I love roller coasters. And I'm like, oh, dang it, I'm having a panic attack. Well, why did you think you were having a panic attack? Well, because my heart was racing. Well, could it be that you were excited? So they're misreading their body cues. Because when you're anxious, your heart races. But when you're excited, your heart races too. But if your interoception is telling you that everything I feel when I'm anxious and my blood pressure raises up and my body is tensing up, that must be all bad, then I'm misinterpreting and misreading what my body's actually doing. So interoception is one of those senses that is most negatively impacted by anxiety. For adults as well too. We're misreading those cues and we're thinking that this is telling me that something bad is happening. What I find for a lot of adults and teenagers especially is the time of day that's the worst for them. What do you think is the time of day that tends to be worse for people with anxiety? Is morning, afternoon, evening, bedtime? Evening. Evening. Because the world is quiet. Everything is settled down. You've maybe spent the entire day avoiding, distracting, busying yourself, pretending like those things don't bother you. And now everything is quiet. And all that, those senses, all those memories, all those things that are in your mind that you've been avoiding all day, now you have to face them in the quiet of the night. When you have no other people, no other person around you, and everything else is kind of at your distance from you. So that's when we have to be aware of throughout the day, is aware of what is my body telling me and not to misinterpret those cues and those signs. So emotions overwhelm logic centers in the brain, which means in our prefrontal cortex, which is the front part of our brain, that is the last part of the brain to develop. That part of the brain grows until age 26. And that part of the brain helps us with emotional regulation, logical reasoning, impulse control, problem solving, decision making, flexibility, like a ton of stuff. And when we get overwhelmed, when some emotion happens that we don't really like and feels uncomfortable, our logic centers shut down, which is why people are like, well, what if the thunder destroys your house? Well, thunder doesn't destroy your house. That's like literally, right? That's logic, that's true. But what if? Emotions make absolutely no sense. And once your emotions are unleashed, it's like this wild animal on the downstairs part of your house, like the Tasmanian devil, just running. And you're trying to get to the upstairs, which is the logic center, but you can't get there because there's all this mess going on downstairs. And once your emotions are triggered, you cannot think logically, which is what happens with anxiety. We get triggered and we have all these irrational thoughts of all these what if, when it may not even happen. I had a kiddo that I saw a couple years ago, and she was afraid of going on her school bus for any field trips. And she was 9 years old. And she was saying, well, what if I get into the bus and I die? I'm like, okay, well, that's a huge leap. So I'm like, so what exactly would cause your death in the bus? And she's like, well, you know, we sit in the bus and there's no seatbelts. And I was like, well, yeah. I mean, why aren't there seatbelts? And she's like, well, yeah, why aren't there seatbelts? So what if we crash? And then, you know, and then we can't get out. So then I'm like, well, let's look it up. Let's look up why there aren't seatbelts in a bus. Because I didn't know. So we looked it up. And they were saying because of the high profile of the bus, that seatbelts aren't necessary because, you know, even if you hit something, it's less likely to have an impact because the height absorbs the shock, all that kind of stuff. And the seats are so close that you would stay safe. And actually having seatbelts and wearing them is actually more dangerous in a bus in a case you have to escape easily. Okay? But I didn't tell her that part. And then we looked up in terms of how many crashes actually occur in the United States with buses. And it was like 0.000. Like it was such minuscule in terms of how often it happens. And she's like, oh. So it's not likely that I would even, you know,
die in a fiery death in a bus because of the, I said, no, the likelihood is very, very small, okay? And so as she was understanding logically, because she's not in the moment right now, she could accept what the logic tells her. But then she's like, well, what if I get scared anyway? And I said, well, then just learn to be scared and sit with it and then do it anyway. Do it anyway. Do it while scared. And what we started doing was thinking about riding in the school bus, so doing it in imaginal exposure. So thinking about packing up your lunch, getting the clothes you want to wear for the field trip, getting to the school bus, getting in the school bus, sitting in it, going up. It's like actually everything in the imagination. And then we started drawing it out. Then we started looking at videos of kids on school buses. And then I had her parent actually go to the school next to the school bus, sitting in the school bus. So that's that incremental graduated exposure where you're going to slowly go from the imagination to in vivo, which is in real life. Okay. So because we want to make sure that emotions and logic match up. So this is one of my favorite examples in terms of visually of what happens with anxiety and the cycle of anxiety. You have this anxious kind of trigger, whatever it is, dogs, snakes, flies, bugs, whatever it is. Then you avoid, right? Because you think, if I'm afraid of something, I should avoid them, right? But when you avoid it, then what happens? Oh, I feel much better because I have this short-term relief. Because if I avoid it, then I feel better. But the problem with that is that the more you avoid, you start to create connections in your brain that in order to feel better, you have to avoid. And then what happens is that you have long-term anxiety growth. So then what happens the next time you face the fear is that it's bigger the next time. So fear over time gets larger with avoidance. So then the next time you have it, you're like, okay, I'm definitely avoiding this time. And then it short-term relief, long-term growth. And then that's why someone may start out with having one fear, and now they have two, and now they have five, and now they have 10, because anxiety and growth occurs with avoidance. Okay. Any questions about that? Does that make sense? Okay. So here is how anxiety shows up. So if you, your child, your teen wants to get therapy and interventions for anxiety, regardless of your age, you should really find a therapist or a psychologist who treats anxiety from all four areas of functioning. Because if you just do it from, say, medication, you may just be getting it physical, and then you're not addressing anything else. I am not against medication for psychological issues. I think what often happens, though, is that the medication only addresses physical, just like with depression. It is addressing certain areas of it, but you're not learning anything else. So I always believe that whatever you're going to do in terms of treatment, you should have a holistic way of treating. Okay? So anxiety shows up physically with your heart racing, sweaty hands, shaky limbs, feeling ill, nauseous, or dizzy. So many people who have anxiety or some kind of panic disorder, they will often see their medical doctor or pediatrician before they see a therapist, for example, because it often shows up that way. Many times emergency rooms are filled with people who actually just have anxiety. It's not a heart attack. Okay? It feels very much like that. Behavioral signs of anxiety are things like isolation, poor eye contact, avoidance, indecision, and procrastination. So yes, procrastination is actually a sign of anxiety. When you have a kid who's avoiding something, not wanting to face something, or you're like, you know, oh, I know I have to work on this project. Let me clean the toilet. All of that, that procrastination is anxiety because it's the fear of being overwhelmed, the fear of failure, the fear of not being perfect. Okay, so procrastination anxiety is very much hand in hand. Emotional anxiety are things like tearfulness, irritability, being easily agitated, feeling sad, depressed, or overwhelmed. So depression and anxiety often are like besties. They show up very much together, and you'll see things like that agitation and irritability, especially with children. And then the cognitive or the mental part of it. So things like racing thoughts, foggy brain, feeling forgetful or having negative thoughts or very like catastrophic thinking. That is also part of anxiety as well. So if you're going to get treatment for it, for yourself or your kiddo, you really want to have a provider that addresses all parts of it, whether it's through nutrition, medication, cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure, workbooks, DIY, any of that kind of stuff. You need to address it from all four. So I want to drop some kind of truths about anxiety. Anxiety lies to you. It takes the truth and distorts it. What if, and then it's like the worst possible scenario, okay? So always keep it in mind. Anxiety is never satiated or satisfied. It's like this little greedy little monster that every time you feed it an anxious thought, it's like, yeah, but what if? And it's constantly, always, it's never satisfied. That's why every time your kid is like, yeah, but what if I go to school and the kids pick on me? Oh, but you'll be fine. Yeah, but what if the teacher doesn't like me? Oh, things would be good. Yeah, but what if I, you know, have to go to the bathroom and it's gross? Yeah, but they clean it every day. Yeah, but what if I don't, like, it's never enough. So that over-reassurance actually does not help anxiety, okay? Our brain's job is to keep us alive and to keep us safe. And sometimes it gets too good at its job and warns us of every possible danger. And that's what we call hypervigilance. And hypervigilance is really about we're scanning and scanning and we're looking for all the inconsistencies of what's going on and what's going wrong, which then makes us feel more uncomfortable. And then anxiety is very common and genetic. So if you have a child with anxiety, you might actually be struggling with anxiety and never dealt with it, or maybe you had it as a child, maybe you have it in your family history. There's a lot of research in this topic I like talking a lot about, and you can look it up for more information too. It's called Adverse Childhood Experiences. And ACEs, there's a ton of research about adverse childhood experiences that if an individual has had four or more of these ACEs, they're more likely to have a kid with psychological issues. So things like abuse, neglect, homelessness, domestic violence, a parent who was incarcerated, those kinds of things. If you have four or more of the 10 of these adverse childhood experiences, you are more than likely to have a child who struggles with those things too. It actually gets passed on genetically, okay? And then anxiety can be learned, so that means it can be unlearned. And that's the good news. So although you or your kid may have a lot of anxiety going on, it's a learned behavior. It's a learned thinking process. So it can also be unlearned, and that's the good news. It doesn't have to be something that you struggle with, okay? I've seen lots of, I hear lots of people say, oh, this is just who I am, I'm just an anxious person, I'll always be anxious. That is absolutely not correct. You might be more predisposed to it, just like we're predisposed to many other things in our family history, but it doesn't mean you have to suffer with it. Okay, so let's get to some practical tips then. All right, one is to build distress tolerance. And this is a really important one because this just means you have to build you and your kids' tolerance, the ability to handle things that are stressful so that they're not always running away when things get hard. So when my son tells me, oh my gosh, math is the worst. It's so hard. Fourth grade is the worst. And I'm like, it's supposed to be hard because if it was easy, you wouldn't be in fourth grade. And then he's like, oh. Like it's just being able to tolerate not knowing the information. It's okay if you don't know. It's okay if it's hard. And so it's about really building up your ability to handle when things are difficult, okay, and not running away from it. Another one that's really important is learning to sit with uncomfortable feelings. There's been some articles that I've read that said it's an interesting thing that when you have an uncomfortable emotion, if you allow yourself to just sit with it, what happens is that it starts to shift in about 90 seconds. And it's interesting because when I, a couple of months ago, a family member of ours passed away and we went to the wake. And when we first went there, it was my niece's dad had passed away and she was just losing it. She just felt really, it was just so overwhelming just being there. But it was very interesting because as we sat there, you could feel the energy in the room shift from just being really heightened. But as we were sitting there, it just started to settle and settle and settle. Not because we were avoiding, because we were sitting there in our just grief. And that's the same thing that happens with anxiety. It's avoiding it doesn't make it go away. That's what I told her. I said, I know this is hard, but you being here and you working through all the feelings that you have, that's gonna help you heal, okay? And then talking through the emotions and making connections between thoughts, feelings, and behavior. Okay, so why do I feel afraid of this? Or why does this make me anxious? Oh, well, because every time this happens, it reminds me of this, which then makes me feel like this. You know, every time, I don't like studying for my test because every time I think about studying, I think, well, what if I flunk? And now again, I'm a failure and it reminds me of high school. Whatever it is, like, we have to make those connections, because often that connection is what's making us avoid, which then makes us anxious. Some other practical strategies is, I find one of the best things is education. So like what you're learning right now, when you are empowered to know what's going on, when I looked up the fatalities of bus and field trips for that girl, education actually can be very empowering. Now, again, we want to make sure we don't overshare, right? But it's about just educating yourself so that you understand, why is this such a struggle? Why is this an issue? Deep, relaxed, and diaphragmatic breathing is actually a really, really good one. Why? Because anxiety also is physical. And a lot of trauma and those negative experiences are stored in our bodies. So we have to make sure that we're doing diaphragmatic breathing. Because what has we've often found is that most people are breathing about 15 to 30 breaths per minute, and we're supposed to be breathing 10 to 15. So really slowing down our breathing, because we tend to breathe from up here, and that's stressful breathing. That's what creates a lot of high blood pressure and body issues, and tension in our bodies. But breathing from our diaphragm helps to relax our entire body, and it brings down the stress inside of your body. So that's a really important one. Progressive muscle relaxation. What that is basically tensing and relaxing each muscle group. So you can start from your eyes, your cheeks, your neck, your shoulders, your chest, your back, kind of going all the way down, because most of us will store our physical anxiety in some part of our body. Okay? So tensing and relaxing each muscle group. So tensing and you breathe in, you relax and you breathe out. And what that does is that it really starts to redirect that attention. So like when I discovered that I was doing a lot of grinding of my teeth during the day and didn't even realize I was doing it, just being aware of that and saying, okay, ooh, I'm grinding, okay, tense, okay, and then having my jaw kind of just hang like a hinge. Or even the way I sit when I'm doing my Zoom sessions, okay, wait, I'm leaning forward, okay, bring back my shoulders, tense, and then relax. So just being aware of your proprioception, knowing where your body is in space, can help with that anxiety. Visual and sensory imagery is one of my favorite ones, because what that will do is it'll help a lot of those images that we have with anxiety. Because if we tell someone, okay, well, just calm down, like, that never works, right? So the visual and sensory imagery is being able to kind of have in your imagination the preferred image you would like to replace that anxiety response with. So the one that I would do is, doing the breathing, doing the muscle relaxation, and then imagining and doing all the senses. So the one that I often went to is like growing up on an island. So I would picture the colors of the sunset, the sound of the ocean hitting the shores, the smell of the salt water, the taste of mango, the feeling of the sand between my toes. So having all of those senses and having that imagery, what that could do is help in terms of falling asleep with a lot of that nighttime anxiety. Can help a child replace those fears of a nightmare, for example, and doing a different dream. I've had kids, little kids, when they're afraid of having a nightmare, for example, have their parents get like a white pillowcase and then getting fabric paint. And then they paint the dream they would prefer to have on the pillowcase. So when they put their head on, their brain can absorb it because they believe that stuff. Right? So having something that changes that, or even talking to them, okay, what is the dream that you don't like to have? Okay, let's change the beginning, or let's change the ending. Or when you see the creepy house, how about just keep walking past the creepy house? You know, I talked to my daughter, she was having a lot of bad dreams at one point. And I told her, she's like, yeah, I had this image of this creepy thing coming up the stairs. I'm like, oh, that's really creepy. And I said, how about you just turn around and like kick it down the stairs? And she's like, ooh. And so that's what she's like, okay, it's just a dream, it's just a dream. We'll kick you down the stairs. And so just helping them understand, like, lucid dreaming, being aware that I'm dreaming so that I can take control of those thoughts, okay? So when you can empower your kids to do those things, it can be really, really amazing for them to get past it, get through it. Behavior and health habits is also a really important one. Now, for the adults in the part of that, things like smoking, alcohol, those things actually make anxiety worse. Because if you're smoking, for example, right before bedtime, and then you're sleeping, and the nicotine then starts to get out of your system, it'll wake you up to get another hit of tobacco. So many times you'll misinterpret that waking you up in the middle of the night as, oh, what's going on? What's wrong? Plus, because your body is craving the nicotine. Same thing with alcohol. If you drink too much before going to bed, even though it does make you very tired, it gives you a very light sleep, And then again, some your body is more easily awakened because of that.
Physical activity, exercise, enjoyable activities, and social activities are one of the best ways to combat anxiety and depression because, again, you're then controlling how your heart rate is moving and how it cools down with the physical activity. Enjoyable activities, doing things that are value added. If you like nature, going out in nature, if you like being around other people or doing things that are fun, whatever, it's like doing things that are value added can really help with anxiety because that way your focus isn't so much on avoiding, you're actually experiencing life. And then social activities, meaningful social activities, not just online, on text, but having interactions with people that are actually valuable. So these are some others that I wanted to throw up there, just as things that I think could be really important with kids.
Using language that's very metaphorical and very image-based is really important for them because a lot of children's books and children's TV shows, that's what they use, okay?
So telling them things like, oh yeah, when you have that anxious thought, just change the channel, just change it. We could change it to the thing that we want to think instead. Or let's change the story.
So when you start to tell yourself, well, what if this, this, this? Well, what if the good stuff happens? What if something doesn't happen that's as bad as that? And looking at all those scenarios, because what you're doing is you're building their schema or their file system for when this happens is what I can do instead. What if you go to the new school and no one talks to you? Then what? I could talk to the teacher. I could find that one kid that looks like they're also shy like me. I could just wait, right? Well, what if other kids do talk to you? Oh, well, then I could do this. So don't just look at the worst case, also look at the best case scenario. And then change the ending. You know, what if you go to the party and you do leave with two new friends? What would that be like? What would that look like? So really helping them think of things differently. Like as I talked about earlier, stay with the emotion and allowing it to shift. So that means literally sitting with your kid or your teenager and saying, oh, I feel so worried. Okay, let's just sit here and be worried together. And just sit. Don't rush them through. Just let them sit with it. Okay? It won't last forever. Identify the real emotion. Like I said, the kid who thought he was anxious at the roller coaster with his friends, he was actually excited. Like, what's the real emotion going on here? And then taking a break. Sometimes, you know, we get so focused, like especially now, we're so mental health focused now. Like, yeah, mental health is amazing. We're bracing it all. That I think people are like overdoing it now. They're like, oh, okay, everything is enough. Be looking at ourselves all the time. So sometimes you need to just take a break and it's okay. It's okay. Practice the situation in the imagination. That's the imaginal exposure, like actually playing it out in terms of a good ending or a different kind of ending. And then practice the situation through role playing. That is one I like doing a lot with kids, and I have parents do a lot with kids. Like actually like pretend you're in class. For example, if they have social phobia. So that you're in class and you're sitting next to them and you role play how to talk. A lot of kids and teenagers and college students, my husband teaches college, like a lot of them do not know how to talk. They do not know how to interact. I'm like, how do you not have any social skills? Right? So teaching them how to engage with someone. Like, okay, what if you go to school and you want to make a friend? How do you start a conversation? How do you end a conversation? How do you know when someone no longer wants to talk to you? Okay, how do you compliment somebody appropriately? Okay. So all of these things could be really great to kind of help them overcome and work through some of that anxiety. So again, frame the worry as a simple statement. So what if, you know, what if I go on the bus and we all crash and die? Well, what if you go on the bus and you really enjoy yourself? Okay? But I know you're concerned that you're going to meet your ultimate death. But what if you go and you really enjoy it? Think about, why do I think this? Where did it come from? Why are you afraid of riding a bus? Where did that thought come from? Oh, I saw a news story about blah, 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 blah. Okay, maybe we shouldn't watch the news before bedtime. Okay, so really thinking about, where are these fears coming from? If I didn't believe this, who would I be? Oh, I would ride on a field trip every week. Okay, so really helping them think about what are the words they would say to themselves? What is the behavior that would be different? How well is this belief serving me? Having this fear of fiery death on a bus, is this helping you? Is this adding to your life or is this taking away from you? Find the positive and the strengths about that. Oh, when I go on the bus, I can actually meet new people. I could overcome a fear. I could know that I can survive this. It could be okay.
Find evidence that proves a positive. Oh, it says that only 0.000% of deaths end on a school bus. Okay, well, great. That means my chances are really good that I'll survive this. That's awesome. And then what would I say to a friend? So we tend to have like the best advice when it's somebody else. So what would you say to a friend? That's where you can do a role play. Okay, so I'm your friend. Dude, we cannot go on this bus. We're probably going to die. No, don't say that. You know, and then what would you say to a friend if they had the same thought? And how can I build evidence against this belief? Okay, well, then we're going to do a PowerPoint. This is what, this is the stats. This is this, this, this is this. And this is why there's seatbelts or no seatbelts. This is why, because the high profile, this is, and really building evidence against it, like you're an attorney, that you're going to do a proof and evidence against these worries. So remember, avoidance feeds anxiety. And avoidance is, it's about the avoidance of the discomfort of the anxiety. We don't like feeling uncomfortable, which is why we avoid. It's okay to feel uncomfortable. And avoidance prolongs anxiety and it prolongs the problem. People think, oh, I'm being a bad parent if I empower my kids to face their fear or I tell them to sit through the thing. It's like, no, you're actually being really a good parent when you do that. It's okay to face things that are uncomfortable. Now, these are some helpful self-scripts and things you can also teach your kids as well. So if they're having things like fear, you could say for yourself, of course I'm scared. It's okay to be scared when things are scary. You can tell your kids to say the same thing. Of course it's scary. It's your first time doing this. It's your first time meeting this person. Of course you feel scared, okay? If there's discomfort, you know, lots of people feel uncomfortable. It's okay to feel uncomfortable when things are so uncertain. Yeah, of course, because you want your body and your brain to tell you and you want it to be in alignment with the truth. So yes, it's okay to be uncomfortable. Or if things feel unfair, yeah, I know it feels unfair. It's hard to feel that way. I think so often as parents, we try to rescue our kids from their distress and we try to fix it, and that's not what they need. And I know that because that's what kids have told me. They've told me, you know, I tell my parents like, oh, it sucks that, you know, we had to move. And you're like, oh, you should be grateful. This is a better school district. That is not what they said. They say that it sucks. Like, join them in that. Join them in how it feels bad or unfair. And because what often happens as parents is that I think we take it personally. We think it's a personal attack. There's something that I've done wrong. I'm a terrible parent. You know, I've scarred them for life. Like, no, just sit with them in whatever they feel and let them know that, yeah, it does kind of suck that we had to move when you had to leave all your friends. And then as you join with them in that resistance and you join with them in their misery, you can actually then open up the conversation to what's really going on and find out what the real issue is behind their distress. So even though a lot of anxiety and worries, well, not anxiety, a lot of worries and fears are normal, there are times when you should seek additional help, okay? So when your behavior, reactions, and emotions become intense and out of control and you don't feel like you're yourself, that's something you should be considering. If you feel impaired in your functioning in some way, that you're not able to go out or engage or whatever it is that you're doing, if you feel like you're not functioning the way you normally and feeling out of control or your home feels unbalanced, and the same applies to your kids. If they just need someone other than you to process things with, or you want to process something with another person other than your family, your spouse, because sometimes you just need to get an outside view. So like my team and I in San Antonio, we offer a lot of that to parents. We do a lot of parent coaching, and there's lots of parents that I meet with that it's just like maybe one or two sessions because they want to like, okay, my kid is doing this, is this normal? Or am I doing the right response? Is this okay? And then sometimes that's all they need. Sometimes they need more support. So one of the, a really good resource if you're looking for someone, because I know it's harder nowadays to find people, Psychology Today is a really good resource because you can go on Psychology Today and you can type in your zip code, you can type in, you know, look at all the criteria in terms of ages, problems, diagnoses, and you can look at every person's profile on there, whether they're a master's level, doctorate level, what their experience is. A lot of them have videos, short videos, and you can check out their website. So you really want to feel comfortable with whoever you seek out services from because you're going to be very personal, talking about a lot of personal stuff. And this is my information. So you can go online at anewdaysa.com is my website. I have a team of individuals who sees children all the way up through adults. And then we also do parent coaching. And then Instagram at dr.annelise.lockhart. And then Facebook, as my kids have said, for the old people. I'm into the 21st century. No, lots of people use Facebook still. So you can find me on the New Day of Pediatric Psychology. And if you need further resource, there's lots of resources on there. And I also have about eight or nine parenting courses. If you have kids who are highly sensitive, kids who are anxious, kids with tantrums, a wide variety of different things like that. This bundle specifically has eight of my top selling courses on there, so you can get it all together. And they're all recorded live, they're about an hour. So that's the resources for you.